Cedric Muhammad.
Look up on your screen, if you're watching me on Ustream or blackelectorate.com. Two men up there, one elder statesman, the other one a young warrior. Both of them the masters of non-threatening Caucasian presentation. I could be speaking of none other than Dick Clark and Ryan Seacrest. Article in today's Wall Street Journal called Moving On. Column is Moving On. When it's time to pass the baton. And this, the AI, Allen Iverson retirement thing got me into this hip-hop artist. The older hip-hop artist not wanting to accept that there's a younger generation out here who has the baton, the throne, the scepter. Let's read this article together. When it's time to pass the baton. It says 10/9/87. This New Year's Eve, Dick Clark will again be on TV, counting down the seconds to midnight. But in his slurred speech, the result of a 2004 stroke, some of us can't help but hear the countdowns in our own lives to the end of our careers, to the difficulties of old age, to the decisions we must make about closing chapters that defined us. Dick Clark turned 80 this past Monday, and a lot of people consider him a hero for remaining on the job. They see him as a role model for resiliency and a vital steward of New Year's Eve, a holiday designed to look back as well as forward. They ask, why surrender December 31st to the young? Others argue that Mr. Clark has become an inappropriate symbol of what should be a happy celebration, because he reminds viewers of sadder things, the ravages of illness and the hazards of aging. Do you all feel this way when you see Dick Clark? I know some of you watch Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's on ABC. Is this ruthless or this just business? They want Dick Clark off air because he depresses them. Hearing him in slurred speech, looking older than they remember him. I'm going to read that last paragraph again. It says here, others argue that Dick Clark has become an inappropriate symbol for what should be a happy celebration because he reminds viewers of sadder things, the ravages of illness and the hazards of aging. He had his time, they say. He ought to let go of the baton and allow a younger generation to run with it alone. We heard similar drumbeats around 80-year-old Bobby Bowden, the legendary Florida State football coach. In the wake of the team's lackluster record this year and calls for his resignation, he announced his retirement on Tuesday. Meanwhile, Oprah Winfrey has confirmed that she will end her talk show in 2011. After she completes 25 seasons. This show has been my life, she said, and I love it enough to know when it's time to say goodbye. Now, a lot of boxers. Oh, Roy Jones. Did Roy Jones? I heard Roy Jones got knocked out in the first round this morning. Did Roy Jones get knocked out in the first round? Was it today? It's time for Roy Jones to retire. A great article here. When it's time to pass the baton in today's Wall Street Journal. Dick Clark, is it time for him to sit down? These public figures remind us of the hard decisions that often accompany letting go. It is an inexact process. It can be a mistake to leave a job too early, and it can be easy to stay too long. A lot of people retire because they have enough money. I call them the bored affluent, says John Sondricker, who retired in 2003 at age 60 as an executive vice president at Wells Fargo Financial. Golf will never replace a good career, but staying too long in a job can be worse. I've heard from readers over the years offering sharp advice about clinging to a fading career. Here is how one summed it up. When the horse dies, dismount. I gotta read that again. Sharp advice about clinging to a fading career. When the horse dies, dismount. When people can't bring themselves to retire, it is often because they look for evidence that confirms their urge to hold on, says Richard Stalen, a professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, who studies confirmation bias. Those who hang on too long tend to ignore things that would tell them it's time to leave, he said. Since his stroke, Dick Clark's show has continued to be television's highest or top-rated New Year's Eve program. It's not as if he's a football coach whose team has stopped winning, says Larry Klein, the show's longtime producer. We don't have losing seasons, he says. We win every single year. I'm reading an article today in light of AI retiring and coming out of retirement to sign with the Sixers, in light of Roy Jones getting knocked out in the first round. The science and business of retirement. When it is time to pass the baton. Also, feedback from viewers has been far more positive than negative, says Mr. Klein. They say Dick shows strength and courage. He created the show. He's an American institution. He deserves to decide on his own when and if he'll leave. Dick Clark, who launched his New Year's Eve show in 1972, declined to comment for this column. Well, 72 to 2012 would be 40 years. Maybe he's going to stop after 40 years. I don't know. Dr. Stalen wonders if Mr. Clark and his team are subconsciously focusing only on the positives. The high ratings, the complimentary fan mail, they may not be giving equal weight to other questions. Are Mr. Clark's limitations compromising a show that might be stronger without him? How will these post-stroke years change the public's perception of him? Will he be remembered for the telegenic charm of his prime or for being an entertainer who held on too long? It's hard to view others with ourselves with clear eyes, says Dr. Stalen. He uses himself as an example. He is 70 and believes his teaching skills are undiminished. But I may have confirmation bias, he says. I'm going to keep going with this. You all can give me your version, personal stories. Time to give something up. Time to retire. It's time for Luke on General Hospital to retire. If you all want to nominate some people that you think should retire, you can just type it in. I think Luke on General Hospital, time to give it up. It's been a hell of a run. Any rappers you think should give it up, let me know. Jack Rigby, a 58-year-old dentist in Hudson, Ohio, has gone through all the stages of leaving and grieving for a job. In 2005, suffering from liver disease that left him fatigued and in pain, he made a hard choice. He wrote to 1,200 patients saying that with great sadness, he was giving up his practice. A younger dentist would take over. More than 250 of the 1,200 patients wrote back, and their loving and supportive letters sustained Dr. Rigby through his 2007 liver transplant. Reading the letters became a retirement ritual for him. On mornings when he yearned to go to work, he sometimes get up early and sit at home paging through the letters. I had them stacked up when I was feeling badly. It helped to read them. Over time, he realized that pining for his job wasn't going to help him move forward. And so this past August, he decided to get rid of the letters. He could have just thrown them away, but he wanted to do something more meaningful. He took out his paper shredder and read each letter one last time before feeding it into the machine. I was pretty emotional, he says, but I'm glad I did it. You can't walk two trails. I can't go back to being a dentist. I now look at those letters as a lifeboat which supported my passage to this new place and time. The medicine that Dr. Rigby takes leaves his hands trembling, so he knows he will never return to administering anesthetic and drilling teeth. But he's grateful that in retirement he has been able to re-embrace his love of photography. Because he uses a tripod with his camera, his tremors don't matter. Dr. Rigby says he hears from former patients who are happy with the young dentist who took over his practice. And though it saddens him that he will never get to work with his son, who will soon graduate from dental school, he is buoyed to know that newer generations are carrying on the work he loved. Likewise, Mr. Sonderrecker, the retiree from Wells Fargo, says he feels a sense of accomplishment in retirement, knowing he trained and mentored dozens of people who are still there. Amy Fishman, a consultant who specializes in marketing to different generations, says those contemplating retirement should measure success by how well they perform as mentors. In that regard, she thinks Dick Clark is doing okay. Since December 31st, 2005, Mr. Clark has shared New Year's Eve's hosting duties with Ryan Seacrest of American Idol, who is 34 years old. We need to honor our aging and we need to honor our young, Ms. Fishman says. America was built on the cooperation of generations working together. When Dick Clark and Ryan Seacrest are together, it shows us that we don't have to be afraid of aging and we don't have to promote youth to the exclusion of old age. Dick Clark knows he won't be the New Year's Eve host forever. Like band leader Guy Lombardo, his tenure will end. For now, perhaps we should pay attention to his exchanges with Mr. Seacrest and to the high-spirited ways he introduces acts 50 years younger than he is. In today's splintered media world, there aren't many places anymore where several generations still share the same stage. Until Mr. Clark decides to retire, this image of him passing the baton, however slowly, may serve all of us well as we consider our own paths and the emotional countdowns to come. That was a good article. When it's time to pass the baton, today's Wall Street Journal, I think we should standing ovate. Did that hit home with any of you all? I had to stand and applaud that. When it's time to pass the baton, written by Jeffrey Zaslow, Z-A-S-L-O-W, in today's Wall Street Journal. Look at that picture, Ryan Seacrest and Dick Clark. I had to say that is a good point. I mean, the fact that you can see Ryan Seacrest and Dick Clark, I think takes away, or should take away, some of the sting. You know, I think Dick Clark is secretly trying to make it to 2012 for his 40th anniversary. Send in your comments. Well, we cover a lot of ground on this show. Rod Gignon, I think he's checking out an hour early. Shane from Houston. I can't read this. I don't want to talk about death, Shane. Rephrase that. Rephrase that, my brother. He's just letting me know the way he feels about Dick Clark. I can't read that. Prince Akbar from The Shy, he says, I think this disrespect of the elderly and older is reflected in your Wall Street story. I think Roy Jones and Allen Iverson should retire and move on. I hope that Iverson doesn't end up like Marbury. This dollar is about to collapse and those brothers still think life is about basketball right now. Let me give you all, and I must come clean. I predicted that Miguel Cotto would beat Manny Pacquiao. What was I thinking, right? Floyd Mayweather I don't know if he's at his absolute best. I think he's close, but I think he's on the other side of the hill. Floyd Money Mayweather, he's still in his prime. He's not at his peak. How do you like that? Money May in his prime, but not at his peak. Same with Jay-Z. This album brought him back into his prime, but not his peak. But this may be the biggest or most successful Jay-Z's been commercially. Not a classic album, but an excellent commercial album. I did not see Empire State of Mind being the number one song in America. Of course, a lot of that had to do with the Yankees being in the World Series and A-Rod throwing the diamond up in the Yankee parade. That never hurts. Anyway, here's I thought some intelligent commentary on the implications of a Manny Pacquiao Floyd Mayweather fight. I think Pacquiao was at his peak, the peak of his prime. Mayweather is not at the peak, but he's still in his prime. John Scully, very intelligent commentator, right after the Pacquiao Cotto fight. Here's what he had to say.
All right, that was our own Brian Kenny out there in Las Vegas. To reset you now, it's 1 o'clock in the east, 10 o'clock out west. Manny Pacquiao defeats Miguel Cotto, stopped in the 12th round TKO, stopped with 55 seconds in by Kenny Bayless. And we're sitting here with John the Iceman Scully, Will Selva. I'm Deuces Rogers. John, what were the keys to this fight and this Manny Pacquiao victory?
I think the speed was the number one factor, the speed and the explosiveness and maybe the fearlessness that Manny Pacquiao showed. He's so unafraid. He doesn't go up. He uses a tactical mind, a tactical approach. He doesn't show fear. He shows a healthy respect. But when it comes down to fight, he doesn't hesitate. A lot of fighters moving up in weight, they're naturally leery. He doesn't seem to be. He seems to just adjust so well, better than anybody probably in history.
Do you think that may have caught Miguel Cotto off guard, that the fact that, you know, Pacquiao kept moving forward?
What caught him off guard, because I noticed it, I'm sure he noticed it, when they got in the ring, it looked like two totally different weight classes. I actually was slightly hesitant for Pacquiao. I said, man, this guy's just too big. Like before the bell rang, I said, wow, he's just so huge compared to him. And I'm sure he noticed that, and he thought, hey, this guy's going to be leery. He's not going to hit that hard like I'm used to, and I think he learned quickly that this guy is for real. Forget about the size. This guy carries the dynamite.
It seems that throughout the fight, progressively as it went on, clearly Manny Pacquiao looked fresher. What do you contribute that to?
A lot of it's adrenaline. I mean, he's winning. He's excited. He's landing punches. He feels the energy from the crowd. Seeing him walk out to the crowd, he certainly is a guy that brings energy. He soaks up energy, and I think that played a big part of it. And his adrenaline, realizing how strong he felt compared to the guy. Because a fighter can sense. You're in there. You feel when a guy's weak. You know it before the crowd knows it. You can sense his punches lacking steam. You can hear him grunting when you're hitting him with body shots, things like that. So I think his adrenaline just kind of went through the roof, and he couldn't contain himself. Like, he had to bounce and show that energy because he was so full of adrenaline.
In the first round, it seemed like Miguel Cotto was dictating the pace, and it seemed that way for the beginning of the second round. Then it seemed Miguel Cotto kind of got out of his game plan, and he was looking for the home run swing. Did you get that sense?
For sure, but again, I never go by the very beginning of a fight because it's too long. 12 rounds is too long. The beginning, there's a lot of nerves. There's a lot of nervous energy. Guys are a little, you know, leery or what have you. I think once he felt some of the power, I think he felt like he needed to land at some bigger shots. In the beginning, he was more controlled. He was working the jab very good, but it didn't seem like that was enough to hold this guy off. He had to bring the pain, and so he felt a little desperation to do that.
Where would you say that Pacquiao's speed compares in with some other boxers right now out there?
Well, it's a different kind of speed. Like, you have your Roy Jones, your Floyd Mayweather. These guys are Shane Mosley, very fast-handed. This guy is fast everywhere. His feet, his legs, his hands, his head, his movement. He's up, he's down. So his overall body speed is premier right now. I'd say he's the best at utilizing his entire body with the speed.
The fight was eventually stopped in the 12th round. Looked like it could have been stopped in the 9th round. Miguel Cotto's corner looked like they were going to stop the fight. Do you agree about, you know, them not stopping it then and the ref eventually stopping it in the 12th round, saying enough is enough?
Well, again, as a fighter, let me get hurt. I want to go. As a trainer, as a viewer, I felt like if you asked me after the 7th round what's going to happen, I would have said he's going to get stopped sooner or later. Like, it was, the writing was on the wall. So it's just that the fact of the matter is you have to let it unfold. If everyone in the building, if all 2 million people watching the fight know that's going to happen, you still have to let it actually happen.
All right, Iceman, final thought on a potential Pacquiao-Mayweather Jr. fight.
It's going to draw, you know, it's a huge fight. It's a huge fight because it draws all the demographics. You know, you have the hip-hop crowd that's going to follow Mayweather. You have the Americans that now are embracing both of them. You have the Filipinos. You have everybody. The Mexicans now that are going to gravitate to Pacquiao. It's one of those fights. It's going to reach. It's going to be all reaching. A lot of big fights don't. They only can draw from a certain group. I think this one's going to have a much bigger pool to draw from. So it's the fight. It's the only fight in boxing I think that matters. If you ask 100 boxing fans what fight do you want to see, 100 out of 100 will say that fight.
No question at all. John Iceman Scully, thanks for joining us here on ESPN News on our post-fight coverage. And
okay, John Scully, I was impressed by his insight, both technical on the fight level and business. I like how he sized up the marketing. Mayweather Pacquiao could do $3 million, $3.5 million maybe. Some say it could do $4 million pay-per-view buys. I don't know. I like Mayweather. I think Mayweather is just a superior fighter. I think you have to look at it kind of like Holyfield and Buster Douglas against Tyson, in the sense that Buster Douglas's jab was world class that night. I mean, all time world class. That jab was on fire. Holyfield's, I think, tactical approach to fighting Tyson the first time he beat him, he was just a smarter fighter. So if you look at the first Tyson Holyfield fight, you know, Holyfield had to weather the storm, but once he got through it, through his tactical game plan and through his physical strength, getting Tyson's respect, he wore him down. I think it'll be something like that with Mayweather. I don't think Mayweather is going to... I don't think there's any way for Mayweather to train in a way that will prepare him for the overall body movements and speed of Pacquiao. Pacquiao punches with his whole body, moves in and out. It's almost like Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. If you look at Muhammad Ali's fight with Joe Frazier, the first one, Muhammad Ali really couldn't time Frazier's punches because of the body movement, the upper body movement, and the fact that Frazier could launch punches when he was in a down, crouched down position. So if you've ever been in a fight, like I have, the punches from weird angles can be a problem. I think Mayweather's reflexes and his defense are good enough for him to survive. But it may be a couple moments there. But I think Mayweather could stop Pacquiao. I wouldn't be surprised if he stopped him. Maybe 10th, 11th round. I'm going to say he'll stop him in the 10th or the 11th round. Mayweather will stop him. Mayweather's going to beat him up in the latter part of the fight. So John Q from Detroit, Michigan, that's my prediction. John from Detroit also wants to know what I think about Shane Mosley. Is he in his prime or at his peak? I think that Shane Mosley is neither. He's neither in his prime nor at his peak, but he fights so infrequently, and he's so smart, and he has such a great trainer in Nazim Richardson that he still could beat anybody on any given day. He's at that point, you know, can beat anybody on any given day, kind of like a Brett Favre. So Shane Mosley could beat Mayweather, I doubt it. He could beat Pacquiao, I doubt it. So, but he's past his prime and past his peak, but he can, you know, he can make it happen once a year. Okay, speaking of this whole idea of whether leaders should retire, whether entertainers should retire, whether athletes should retire, I hear this a lot as it relates to President Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Obi Egbuna, who you all know very well, he comes on our program regularly. He is the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald newspaper. He conducted an interview with one of the individuals that some people say is representative of President Robert Mugabe's commitment to groom or mentor or develop younger leadership. George Charamba, press secretary for the president and the permanent secretary, from what I understand, in the Ministry of Information in Zimbabwe, basically makes him the official spokesperson for President Robert Mugabe. Obi mentioned last time that he had recorded an interview with George Charamba. Very informative. I checked it out yesterday. Obi is also a great fight strategist, as you all know from when I interview him. So we got together recently, talked boxing and Pan-Africanism. Yes. You know you have a real friend if you can build on boxing and Pan-Africanism and the transition is seamless. Let me give you the audio. some background on the history of Zimbabwe. If you are not a supporter of President Mugabe or what he represents, please make your opinion known. Try to engage the facts if you want to do so in this interview. George Charamba of the Ministry of Information in Zimbabwe, the press secretary for President Robert Mugabe, interviewed by Obi Egbunu. Enjoy this.
In particular, the United States and British governments have diverted attention away from the fact that unity has always been at the cornerstone of the political developments and the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe. So what I would like you to begin by doing is doing a comparative analysis of the Patriotic United Front that led to the independence of the country, the Unity Accord that was established in 1987, exactly 7 years after independence, and the current inclusive government.
Well, the quest for national unity in Zimbabwean politics goes as far back as the 1896 Wars of Resistance. You would know historically that the first people to pick up arms against the invaders, the colonial invaders, were the Ndebele people in 1893. That particular struggle was weakened by the fact that it did not embrace the whole country, which is how the Ndebele struggle actually came to grief. But then you have in 1896 a new dimension in that you have both ethnic groups, the Ndebeles and the Shonas, orchestrating some kind of unity effort against the colonial invaders, which is why that particular struggle sustained itself for a good 6 years of hard resistance, to a point where the colonial settler occupiers actually ended up in reinforcements from South Africa. That was the first show of unity in terms of our own struggle. Then you have in 1959, the coming together of the Southern Rhodesia African National Congress. You have the Blue Ear chapter and the Harare chapter representing the two dominant ethnic groups, again forging unity, the Southern African National Congress in 1957, 1958, 1959. NDP, till the philosophy behind our leadership in the nationalist ranks, derived from the need for national unity, transcendental unity that then would be a weapon of struggle against colonialism. Then, of course, in 63, you have the split between ZAPU and ZANU. But something happens in 1974. Having realized the weaknesses of prosecuting a struggle against colonialism from a divided front, the forces of nationalism then realize the need, the value of unity in struggle. In 74, you then have a creation of the African National Congress under Bishop Abel Mzorewa to unite the Riven Zimbabwe African People's Union ZAPU and Zimbabwe African National Union ZANU under this umbrella organization called ANC under Bishop Abel Mzorewa, who was seen as a neutral figure who would, as it were, transcend the divisions that had divided the nationalist ranks in 63. Right? That was 74. Of course, that unity collapsed. Then you have in 76, right, the formation of the Patriotic Front. Again, another bid at unity. 76, that Patriotic Front then creates a united front at Geneva Conference and ultimately Langest House Conference, right? What happens in 1980? You then have the creation of an inclusive government drawing from ZAPU, drawing from ZANU, drawing from the Rhodesia front, right, to try and create a national front for purposes of tactically ensuring that there is some kind of unity, you know. But of course, within it, you have unity as well as very clear attempts to push forward the agenda, the people's agenda. So it's unity within struggle, right? It has always been purposeful unity. Not unity for its own sake, but unity for the sake of consolidating the struggle for the next challenge facing it. Right? This is 1980. Then 82, 83, there's a fallout between ZAPU and ZANU. And then you have the historic 1987 Unity Accord. Well, it was called the Unity Accord precisely because you had two liberation movements sharing the same struggle from the same vantage point, from the same perspective, coming together once more after those episodes of differences. In other words, it was the coming together of people sharing a philosophy, sharing a struggle, sharing a vision. That's what makes it fundamental and stand out as a unique kind of coming together. Now, when you come to 2008, you have the yoking or the coming together of politically dissimilar formations, ZANU-PF on the one hand and the two MDC formations on the other. These are distinct, disparate political forces, quite unreconciled, except through the voter. The voter who says, well, we give ZANU-PF a marginal lead. We give MDC a very significant support level, which therefore robs ZANU-PF of the capacity to create a government in its own right. So there is some kind of balance of forces, you know, between the Patriotic Front forces and the MDC, which means this is really an inclusive government born out of necessity, right? But it is not the coming, the fusion of politics. It is not the fusion of vision. It is not the fusion of even a tradition, to the extent that ZANU-PF is coming from a liberation tradition, while the MDC is coming from a tradition of a neo-colonial politics. So this is a marriage of convenience, as opposed to 87, where you see the coalescence of people who share a perspective, a struggle, a vision in terms of the country that that they want to invent, that they want to found by way of a new Zimbabwe. So that's the basic difference there. Cedric Mohammed.